Our first impulse when a tree dies is to take it down. Better that than to wait for it to rot so completely that it drops big branches or just falls over. But there is a value in some dead trees as wildlife habitat. Lots and lots of animals depend upon trees for places to live. And our first guest knows a thing or two about providing habitat in trees, both dead and living. Brian French is an arborist and tree risk assessor for Arboriculture International based in Portland. He's also the co-founder and president of Ascending the Giants, so he spends lots of time climbing very tall trees. Brian French, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So if you can help it, do you not spend very much time on the ground?
No. Whenever we get back down to the ground, I feel like it's maybe comparable to being on a ship for months at a time and then standing on ground again. But yeah, trees move when we're in them, and you start to, get used to that movement and want to stay in the trees.
How long have you been doing this? Were you a tree climber as a kid and then just sort of turned into something as a career?
Yeah. Like any kid, I think, you know, we climb trees, you know. But as a professional tree climber, I started when I was 18. So this is kind of the only job I've ever had.
Mm-hmm. So what do you know about trees that most of us don't know down below?
Wow.
Everything. How many hours do we have, right?
the movement of trees, I think, is something like if I was to share an experience with somebody who hasn't climbed a tree and take them into the tree, we get all kinds of, when we do take people into trees, we get all kinds of different responses from that. But one of the things I think that really stands out is how there's almost this sound, like this murmur, you know, as this pedestal, you know, 200, 300 foot pedestal to the crown is moving and swaying back and forth. And it, you know, you get up there and you're not expecting it to be moving. It becomes your new ground, you know. You can't even see Earth below you, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that's something that everybody should feel.
So most of us are aware of the fact that things do live in trees. I mean, we see birds and squirrels in them all the time. But what other kinds of critters rely on trees for habitat?
Well, here in the Pacific Northwest, we have many cavity-dwelling species. Cavity-dwelling species are those who rely on dead material in trees. They don't live in caves or fields. They don't just fly around in the sky 24/7. They need a place to reproduce. And the place that they do that is in cavities, specifically in trees. And those are oftentimes the areas that we, both as stewards for, you know, we're concerned about safety as members of our community, but also as arborists, I think those are areas that we target to remove from trees or remove trees because of, without considering the impacts on wildlife.
So we take them off for cosmetic reasons or safety reasons or
both? All the above, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so when you give workshops on habitat trees, is that generally for people who live in built-up areas where there are trees but also lots of people in houses as well?
The focus is really in the urban area. I think that's what I'm trying to address. So we're not necessarily looking at, you know, the national forest. What can we do to enhance wildlife there? But thinking of as we tame our urban areas and change those areas, we still have to consider that we're corridors between these wild areas. And if we can respect wildlife, which we do, I think we all kind of share like some sense of respect for wildlife. But sometimes just knowing what their behavior is and where they live, you know, we can really work with that in our urban dwellings.
So what's a real obvious sort of example? I mean, a case in which somebody might think, well, I should probably get rid of that tree, but then I could leave it for habitat. So what would be some of the factors that would help them make that decision?
Sure. I think a good example would be perhaps something as small as a chickadee, which is a very small bird. It can live in cavities as small as 5 inches diameter in dead wood. So that would be something that would be really easy to identify as like, well, you know, we want to remove this dead branch, but right now we're in breeding season. So knowing what time of the year it is, you know, if it's out of breeding season, then we can remove that. But, you know, sometimes we have to postpone our work or change our plans accordingly.
So if the chickadee is, and other creatures like chickadee that are cavity dwellers, I mean, if the cavities aren't there in trees, I mean, do they really have other options, or is that just it? It's got to be in wood.
So it's a place for reproduction. And they specifically have criteria, just like we do. So, for instance, what kind of room are we in, right?
Uh-huh.
It's square. We've got some windows. We have a roof protection. We like the temperature approximately, 68 to 70 degrees, depending on where you're at and what you're comfortable with. And we like it to be arid. We don't want it to be too moist in our homes. And each species, each one of these species has a different criteria for each of those living places that they live and reproduce.
Will some of these tree cavities be used by different creatures at different times of the year?
Absolutely. Not only will they be used by different creatures at different times of the year, but one type of nest may become another type of nest. So, for example, we have both primary cavity users and secondary cavity users. So with a woodpecker, part of its reproduction behavior is to actually drum and excavate those sites. It won't go and just live in a hole. It wants to create that hole and expose that cavity. And then after it moves away this year, other species like wood duck or other birds will go and move in who can't excavate that themselves.
So the woodpecker does the work and then other things move in after.
That's right.
Woodpecker's like the remodeling crew. We're talking to Brian French here on the Jefferson Exchange about habitat trees. He's an arborist and tree risk assessor for Arboriculture International based in Portland in the Rogue Valley for our workshop tomorrow for arborists. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about trees and what to do to make them more attractive for wildlife as habitat. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Particularly with trees that are completely dead. I mean, how do you find the balance between preserving a snag for wildlife and not creating a hazard that can drop parts on people?
That's really where you got to call an arborist. So part of what arborists do is we assess that risk. And you know, it's actually quite simple. You know, if the tree falls in the woods, did anybody hear it? You know, when we're in town, we're really looking at targets, you know. So if we have pedestrians or a house, vehicles and other, you know, people as well as property that could be damaged by that tree or tree branch, we want to be able to address that safety, you know, risk. And that's really kind of what an arborist's job is working with risk and mitigating for that. So when we're doing that work, there are a lot of opportunities where we can retain parts of that, though, if we just understand what the behavior of those cavity-dwelling species are.
So it's not just that you've had to learn trees, clearly. You've had to become something of an amateur wildlife biologist here as well to understand not only the places that the things live, but when they live there.
Absolutely. Very amateur.
What has been some of the surprises along the years about some of the things you've learned about the tree-dwelling critters?
Wow. Surprises. You know, I guess I could share an experience with you.
Sure.
We were climbing the tallest Douglas fir in the world, actually, which is located between Roseburg and Coquille. And we were actually creating a documentary while climbing it. So we had videographers and a film crew in an adjacent tree. And one of the riggers actually bumped a small stub and revealed behind that this little cavity space, which is where two mating clouded salamander were living 257 feet up this Douglas fir tree. We collected that information, and it was a moment to awe, really, mm-hmm. to see these salamanders so high in a tree. So we collected that information, and we ended up submitting an article in the Herpetological Review that March. And our suspicion is that these actually rely on those large trees. So it's kind of one of those cases where you have another species that you would have never thought would be reproducing so high in the forest. And who climbs these trees? It's not like you just stumble upon these little cavities every day. We put all of that together, and it was a very significant moment where we can look back to and say, this species actually relies on that habitat.
Have you climbed tall redwoods as well?
No.
Okay. I've heard the stories about the earthworms living high up in the redwoods and stuff too, so I haven't seen that though.
No, I haven't really done a lot of work in California. Most of my work is Oregon-centric.
Okay. We are talking to Brian French, an arborist and tree risk assessor for Arboriculture International in Portland, talking primarily about hazard trees, but he's also been way high up in a bunch of other trees as well. You can join us at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Exchange.
Good morning.
Hi.
Is it advisable to delimb a recently dead tree to cut down on the possibility of it being blown down in a good wind?
Absolutely. What I would recommend is to definitely contact an arborist to come in and take a look at that. But when you do have opportunities to leave dead wood or even distribute dead wood, one of the things that is really rare in our communities and even in our parks is hollow dead wood and using dead branches and dead material as something and being able to value that, rather than discarding it as firewood or something that is wasted, because that's actually very useful in our landscapes as well. I'll see some children walk into a park, and if there's a hollow log there, you can sit back and there's a swing set to the left and there's a hollow log to the right. You sit back and you'll see it. Hey, everyone, look, there's a log. it's really incredible. So, Even if you do have to remove parts or the whole tree, finding ways to distribute that around the landscape is definitely recommended.
So even if the wood is not standing, is it also useful as habitat on the ground like that?
Absolutely.
Horizontal?
Yeah.
For what?
Well, you have all of your terrestrial species, too, that rely on all of that dead wood. And there's a great effort nationally to restore lands, wildlands, and rivers, and that's actually the key component to pull all of that together is using that dead material from those trees.
So let's talk about some do's and don'ts. If you want to encourage critters to come and roost in your trees and stuff, I mean, what are some of the good things to do, both to trees living and dead?
Well, if your concern is ants, then I would probably deal with the ant problem in your house. And not necessarily think that, oh, we have to take all of the deadwood off of our property. That's still very useful. So if that kind of answers your question anyway.
All right. So if ants is deal with the place where you live, not with the place where they live.
Exactly.
Okay. Let's take another call from Peter in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Brian French.
Hey, I was wondering if two questions. One is whether or not a Kentucky coffee tree tends to be fairly prone to, you know, dropping limbs and stuff. And secondly, whether or not a crotch angle that is small is more prone to drop a limb versus a large angle on that crotch.
Okay, a couple good questions. Thanks for those, Peter.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. Those are very tough questions to answer. There are some species that are very prone to limb failure. I wouldn't consider the Kentucky coffee tree to be one of those trees that are highly prone to limb failure. Like Ailanthus, Tree of Heaven, for instance, is really well known for that. And some of your faster growing riparian pioneer species like alder or birch. However, all trees may be susceptible to you kind of have to categorize when you're looking at trees' likelihood of parts failing. You kind of have to separate it into health and structure. Healthy trees oftentimes fail. Sometimes dead trees are less likely to fail than living trees, depending on what the structure of the tree is. So the best thing I could do really once again is to recommend your local arborist. I have a friend down here. His name's August Schilling. He has a company down here, but in the Ashland area. But definitely have an arborist come, because the arborist, we are trained to identify that. You know, within a couple of minutes, we could walk around the tree and offer an assessment and be able to answer those questions.
In my search for information about habitat trees, I noticed that there are some signs available. I mean, is there sort of a designation, a certification for a hazard tree?
There's a certification for arborists who get training to be able to answer those questions. But every municipality, every governance or where you would send that information to, if it's a regulated tree, for instance, hazard tree or risky tree, there's definitely ways to find what that likelihood is and be able to manage it.
Brian, do you still serve in the Urban Forestry Commission in Portland?
I do.
So what are some of the things that people can do to pretty easily enhance the urban forest?
Well, I think it really, every town is different. Mm-hmm. Every person and every community is different. Even when you're looking, kind of zooming in on, you know, Oregon from Google Earth, you know, with the whole Earth, you know, we Ashland is very different than Portland. And so I think that the best thing that we can do in our community is ask what our relationship is with our urban forest and what our urban forest provides for us. And then from there, look at what we can do to enhance that and work with our urban forest when recognizing that value and the benefits that they provide for us.
Okay, so are people getting the message, though, that maybe it's a good idea to when you move into a city that you keep some trees around?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And Ashland has a tree board as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so people aware that the trees are good things to have in cities. Okay, Brian French, thanks for joining us today. He's an arborist and tree risk assessor for Arboriculture International in Portland, and he's also the co-founder and president of Ascending the Giants, which is also a very fun website to visit. Lots of things going on in tall trees around the region. So, Brian French, thanks for visiting us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for the opportunity.